Hi again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Social Security is celebrating its 75th anniversary this year, and we have two guests with us to talk about the history of Social Security, and I'm sure that we'll branch into the future of the program. It has a fascinating history. In reading some about this yesterday, I didn't know this. Perhaps this is news to your ears as well, but one of the first people to propose a scheme for retirement security was Thomas Paine, who in 1795 called for the establishment of a public system of economic security for the new nation. It was titled Agrarian Justice. It called for the creation of a system whereby those inheriting property would pay a 10% inheritance tax to create a special fund out of which a one-time stipend of 15 pounds sterling would be paid to each citizen upon attaining age 21 to give them a start in life, and annual benefits of 10 pounds sterling to be paid to every person age 50 or older to guard against poverty in old age. Isn't that interesting? We could do show on that at some point. We have two wonderful guests with us. Professor June Hopkins is joining us, Associate Professor of History at Armstrong Atlantic State University, author of Harry Hopkins, Sudden Hero and Brash Reformer. She has been teaching at Armstrong since 1998 and has been head of the history department for the past 4 years. She is now working on a history of World War II and the relationship between Winston Churchill and Harry Hopkins. And Harry Hopkins happens to be her grandfather. Professor June Hopkins, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm very happy to be with you.
Good. Also joining us is Professor Nancy Altman, chair of the board of directors of the Pension Rights Center and author of The Battle for Social Security. She has a 30-year background in the areas of Social Security and private pensions, the author of, well, to round that out, The Battle for Social Security, From FDR's Vision to Bush's Gamble. She is chair of the board of directors of the Pension Rights Committee, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the protection of beneficiary rights. She served for a number of years on the faculty of Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and has taught courses on private pensions and Social Security at Harvard Law School. Nancy Altman, professor, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's start with you. You're with us for a shorter period of time, Professor June Hopkins. This is an idea, as I read at the beginning, that people have been thinking about for a long time. The founders of our country were thinking about the idea of some kind of old age security.
Well, it had been thought about for a long time, and in the Constitution it says that the federal government is responsible for the general welfare. There had been only private charities that were taking care of people who were poor and in need. The government was not, as President Franklin Pierce said, the almoner of the poor. The idea of a government entity providing tax money or revenues for the poor was just not part of our political culture. Organizations, church organizations or private charitable organizations like the AICP, the Association for Improving the Condition of the Poor. These were the organizations that were going to take care of the poor. It was not considered the right of responsibility, nor was it considered proper to give money to the poor who were idle. The idea of the American ideal of independence and work was very much embedded in our culture.
Mm-hmm. And it was your grandfather, actually, maybe we understate his importance, but in reading a bit more about him yesterday, he was extremely close to Eleanor Roosevelt and was extremely close to FDR as well. Mm-hmm. This idea of taking care of the poor was something he brought to that administration and brought to their consciousness in a huge way.
Well, he did, and much of this had to do with his social work background. Mm-hmm. He was a social worker in New York City in the early decade of the 20th century. He worked in a settlement house, and then he worked for the AICP. And he had a social conscience. Some of it was engendered at Grinnell College, where social gospel was very much a part of the curriculum. But he felt very strongly that the government, at some level, needed to take a part in seeing that people who were thrown out of work or were what they call dependent had some kind of safety net. And this he brought to Albany in the early years of the Great Depression. And it's probably because of the economic crisis that hit the nation beginning in October 1929 that these kinds of laws were able to be passed.
Mm.
In New York City, I mean, in New York State, when Franklin Roosevelt was governor, they started the first state-based relief project where money was given to those people who were unemployed. Later, within several months, they provided jobs for these people who had lost their jobs just because of the Depression. So this idea of direct relief money and then work relief jobs was brought to Washington, D.C. when Hopkins went down there to become Federal Relief Administrator in 1933.
Would you agree, Professor Altman, that we could not have had Social Security, which is when you read about it, you think it's unbelievable that this passed, that its time had come because of the economic crisis that we were facing in this country?
Well, it's an interesting point, and I want to also emphasize that Mr. Hopkins was very involved in all aspects of the Social Security Act. The concept is very different from welfare, though. Welfare is a program that they understood during the Depression they needed to get immediate relief to those in need. But the idea of Social Security is insurance against loss of wages. And that was something that is virtually, we're kind of latecomers to it. Much of Europe had this, and now most countries in the world have Social Security. FDR and Harry Hopkins and Francis Perkins, another the Secretary of Labor at the time, understood that you needed welfare to get us out of the Depression and to help people in their immediate needs. But over the long term, in good economic times and bad, we needed insurance, and that was Social Security. So that the Depression aided because so many people at that time, hidden in the shadows of the unemployment figures, were older Americans who had lost their jobs and had moved back in with their adult children, could not find a new job. So when the children were thrown out of work, you had three generations who lost their homes. You had three generations, the worker themselves, and the workers, children, and the elderly parents. So it really brought the issue to a head. But this was old age poverty has been with all of us for a very long time, way before the Depression. In fact, I like to point out that at the time Social Security was signed into law, which was 75 years ago this month, every state but New Mexico had poorhouses, and most people living in poorhouses were people over the age of 60.
Oh, my. There were states, though, that did have some form of Social Security. Fill me in on this, Professor Hopkins.
Well, the Wisconsin economists, the John Common School, had written a unemployment insurance bill, and I think it finally passed. It was written in 1921. It finally passed in 1932. Nancy is so right about this division between social insurance and welfare. The Social Security Act had both. It had old age assistance, which gave money based on need to those people who were old then. And elderly poverty during the 1930s was 50%.
Goodness.
50% of old people in the 1930s were poor. Beginning of the 21st century, that number came down to 10%. People of color in the 1930s, 90% were poor. So they had to do something for the immediate situation. So the old age assistance, as well as aid to dependent children, this is based on need. These were considered welfare, absolutely necessary because of the huge economic crisis we were in. But the social insurance programs, the unemployment insurance, and what old age pensions, what we now call Social Security, was based on the idea of insurance, based on the idea that you contribute. You pay to play.
Mm-hmm.
You contribute money when you're young all the way through. Then when you reach 65, you will draw benefits. When you lose your job, the employer has paid benefits into a kitty, and if you're laid off, you get benefits for a limited period of time. Now, Hopkins believed strongly that the key to economic recovery was jobs, that you had to have unemployment insurance, and Social Security was absolutely, old age pensions, absolutely crucial, but you had to have jobs. So part of the Social Security bill, or the economic security bill that went to Congress, had a piece that assured people who were out of a job of a government job, that a government assurance corporation would be part of this whole cradle-to-grave Social Security for all American citizens. Now, that never got through. It was a little too radical. It was going to cost $9 million. It was too expensive. But the idea that jobs are the way to give people security was foremost in his mind, and it had always been from the early years of the 20th century.
Interesting.
When he was a social worker. And you know, you think about now, unemployment is being extended. And this is what FDR and his administrators were worried about, that it would become too close to what we call the dreaded English dole. And there was always the commitment to separate social insurance from welfare. And that was what the Wisconsin school, all these folks from Wisconsin were very much involved in. Mm-hmm. And having it be contributory so that it could never be taken away.
Part of the Wisconsin idea, the progressive tradition here in the state of Wisconsin. How radical an idea, and how much opposition, and how did all of this get passed 75 years ago, Nancy Altman?
Well, let me say that actually Social Security in many ways is a conservative program. And it was very middle of the road at that time. Let me emphasize some points June made, that the Wisconsin ideal was exactly, it had, in my book I call John Commons, the professor who was at University of Wisconsin in Madison, the grandfather of Social Security. He mentored a number of people who were quite prominent in the development of Social Security. It was, at the time, there was such distress in this country, it was a time of demagogues, and there were lots of radical kinds of ideas. There were, every person a king, the Huey Long and
right.
Sinclair Lewis out in California, and all kinds of things. And there was a doctor in Southern California who saw some old women hunting for food in a garbage can. He was so incensed, he wrote a letter to his local paper, and it turned into what became known as the Townsend Plan, which was this scheme that everybody over age 60 should get a huge sum for that time every month, and the only requirement was that you spend it in the month, so you'd stimulate the economy. It was his idea, and that there were Townsend clubs in every state. Policymakers were being pressured to do that, which was much more radical than Social Security, and what they came up with was a scheme based on very basic American values. Social Security rewards hard work. The more you earn, the higher your benefit. It's wage-related. It is the idea that we have individual responsibility, but we also have concern for our neighbors and our parents. It's many, actually, basic biblical values as well as American values. And it's very conservatively financed. It is paid mainly by contributions from workers matched dollar for dollar by their employer. So that it was, I think, one of the reasons it's been so popular and really stood the test of time was it was ingeniously constructed. There was President Roosevelt in 1934 established the Committee on Economic Security, of which Harry Hopkins was a prominent member. It was just five cabinet members, and they had a staff that developed all of these different proposals. Interestingly, one of their working groups was on health insurance, and they almost proposed national health insurance, but they decided that could sink the whole bill. But they did all of this, but it was very ingeniously crafted. It was by people who really understood both the details of these systems, the international experience, and really, as June said, they were social workers, had worked in state government and really understood the needs of the American people.
Having been through an incredibly contentious debate on health care reform in this country, it's hard for us to imagine in 2010, I think, June Hopkins, that this was a pretty mainstream, middle-of-the-road, not a radical idea back in the 1930s.
Well, health insurance or a national health plan was to be included in the Social Security Act, and it was something that was going to be way too expensive. What they did instead was they had benefits for disabled children, for the blind, for the handicapped, and eventually those became extended over the decades. But one of the documents I can remember reading that my grandfather wrote, and he was very much an advocate of these health plans, was that the doctors were suffering as much as everybody else was suffering, and that there had to be some way to ameliorate their condition as well. So the doctors, while they did have a very strong lobby with the AMA and lobbied against the health plan, there was a concern for all levels of society. But they did have health care for children, and children being the future, and were considered a very deserving group of Americans. And part of the Social Security Act was aid to dependent children, which was what we called welfare until 1996. And that was based on the mother's pensions plan. You know, as Nancy said, these were ideas that were rooted in American traditions, the idea of family, that mothers should stay home and take care of their children, that the gender constructs, the idea about a woman's place being in the home was very strong, that a woman's employment outside of the home is not as valuable as her work inside the home. So ADC provided money for mothers to take care of their children, their dependent children, in fatherless families where there was not a breadwinner, and most of the major breadwinners were, of course, men. Mm-hmm. So it was a very traditional idea, and the Social Security Act in its whole embraced very traditional ideas. And this is what Franklin Roosevelt told to the Committee for Economic Security, that, you know, you go back to our old traditions. He did not want this to seem radical. It would not have gotten through Congress. It would not have gotten through Congress with the health insurance. It would not have gotten through Congress with the federally assured jobs. Mm-hmm. So he wanted it to get through in its entirety as he presented it. Mm. So he did not support those pieces as much as he could. And I don't know if Nancy will agree with me, but I think it got through Congress largely because of the influence of Franklin Roosevelt, that he was so powerful and so influential that he really got this bill through Congress.
And actually, let me jump in and say one other point, too, because I don't want to mislead your listeners, and that is that Social Security had its fierce opponents, and the whole bill did. And there were conservative Republicans who called it socialism, who talked about this was going to be the end of democracy. I mean, some of the rhetoric is quite astounding, that we were pulling down the pillars of the temple and so forth. But Franklin Roosevelt cleverly, he was a terrific politician, and he, 6 months, actually, as he was setting up the Committee on Economic Security, even before it was set up, well before the bill was introduced, he went on radio, one of his famous fireside chats, and he essentially inoculated the population. He said, now you're going to hear people call this socialism and fascism and all these names, but it's really not. It's a return to basic American values. And he had a strong connection with the American people. They loved him. They trusted him. They knew that he was on their side, and he was able to explain to them why this made sense. And as June said, it is rooted in traditional and basic American values. The concept is that in order for capitalism to work, workers need some protection against risks they cannot avoid. Mm. So that as long as you're dependent on wages, you might wind up losing those wages because, as we have now, through no fault of your own, there's an economic downturn, so we have unemployment insurance. You may have a disabling accident and need disability insurance. You may lose a parent. You may die leaving young children who have been dependent on your wages, so you need life insurance, and you can grow too old and need old age annuities. Those are all, we have unemployment insurance. Those were, are currently all, the other three are currently part of Social Security. It was added, the disability insurance was added in 1956. But that's, it's, but that's the basic concept, and it's a concept that's been adopted throughout the world, because as we all are dependent on wages, we're all in danger of losing those wages. And health insurance, even when you have wages, if you have don't have health insurance, that can bankrupt you. And so that was the idea behind that.
Mm. Mm. And it was a model for other countries in the world. Was your grandfather involved in any of that?
Well, in 1934, FDR sent him to Europe to see what European countries were doing about this. And he sent him him to Italy and Germany and England. And Hopkins did not get to meet with Hitler. He was busy doing other things, and he got to meet with Mussolini, and he was not impressed with what was going on in Italy. And he was not impressed with what was going on in England because of this, what turned into a dole, a long-term unemployment insurance that did not have any time limits. He came back to Roosevelt and he said, we have to do this the American way. We have to do it our way. This is a way that we're not going to imitate other countries, although some of the plans are okay. But this is going to be the American way to what Social Security establishes is our welfare system. We're not a welfare state, but we do have a welfare system. We do have a safety net for our citizens. And as after the Social Security Act was passed, and it did have problems, didn't include everybody. It didn't include domestic workers. It didn't include agricultural workers. It didn't include self-employed. It pulled money out of the out of circulation from the payroll tax when we were really in trouble. But despite all of this, it survived, and it was probably the most important piece of legislation passed in the 20th century. Mm. I can't think of anything else, and I don't know of anybody who has not been affected in one way or the other by this. It has been expanded so that it includes survivors and dependent children of people who died before they are 65. It has expanded and improved over the decades to a point where it is an important part of all of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Would you go that far to call it the most important piece of legislation passed in the 20th century?
Absolutely. It was a, and again, just to emphasize this point about welfare and insurance, the concept is that welfare is needed as long as there are people who are poor. The idea of insurance is to prevent people from becoming poor in the first place. And it's done an amazing job. Social Security is the most effective anti-poverty program we have. Every year it lifts 13 million seniors and over a million children out of poverty because Social Security is the nation's largest children's program. Two-thirds of the elderly receive half or more of their income from Social Security. It is a vital program, part of the fabric of this country. And you didn't mention in the introduction, but I am spearheading a coalition called Strengthen Social Security, Don't Cut It, which involves 125 organizations representing over 50 million Americans. And the message is clear that this is a program the American people are united behind. They support it. They believe it's important, and they want it strengthened, improved, perhaps even expanded, not cut.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls, June. It must be quite an honor to be able to say that Mr. Hopkins was your grandfather, isn't it? I mean, what a rich history you have.
Yes, I'm very proud of him. I'm very proud of what he accomplished. It took a great toll on him. He died when he was 55 years old. Mm. He worked himself to death. But he was a remarkable man. He was a man that had administrative talents, and he was not a politician, but his heart was in the right place, and he managed to create these programs, and not just the Social Security Act, but you know the work relief program, the WPA.
Right.
And then on into World War II when he was emissary to Churchill and Stalin. It was a remarkable life.
It was a remarkable life.
Too short, yes.
Yeah, yeah. June Hopkins, thank you so much. Nancy Altman will stay with us for the full hour. June Hopkins, associate professor now of history at Armstrong Atlantic State University, author of Harry Hopkins, Sudden Hero, Brash Reformer. Nancy Altman, chair of the board of directors of the Pension Rights Center and author of The Battle for Social Security and also organizer of Strengthen Social Security. I'm not sure I got all of that title right, but we'll make sure that she clarifies that as we continue. We go to your phone calls in just one moment. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and let's start with Linda from Monroe. Hi, Linda.
Good morning, Kathleen and guests. I'm really enjoying this program. Now, I definitely don't think that they should cut Social Security, and I know they shouldn't keep borrowing from it if it's going broke. Now, what the Republicans want to do by privatizing it and putting it in the stock market would make it even worse. Now, I think what they should do is raise the income limit that you pay Social Security on up to a higher level than just, I think it's around $100,000 right now, but the rich don't like that, and if they need income, then abolish Bush's tax cuts for anyone with an income over $250,000. But the billionaires don't like that either because they couldn't brag how rich they are in the Forbes magazine. And what's your opinion, your guest opinion?
Nancy Altman.
I think you raise a very, very important point. The Social Security is one of the most conservatively managed programs of the entire federal government. It projects out 75 years every year to reassure and to keep monitoring and making sure those benefits can be paid. According to the most recent trustees report, it can pay all benefits in full and on time until 2037. And after that, even if Congress did nothing, three-quarters of benefits indefinitely. There is a projected shortfall. We want to be able to pay 100% of those benefits, but it's modest in size. It is decades away. And as the caller correctly says, it's about the size of extending the Bush tax cuts just for the top 2% of this nation is about the size of the projected shortfall. It could be eliminated by eliminating the so-called maximum, which stands at $106,800 today. There are other ways that can close that shortfall without cutting benefits, without raising the retirement age, and really with only modest increases for those that are able to pay more. That's the Strengthened Social Security Coalition. That's our position. No privatization, no increase in the retirement age, no other benefit cuts. Close the modest shortfall in by having those who are able to pay more pay just somewhat more.
And is that going to be a hard sell?
It shouldn't be, because we've done public opinion polling, and AARP and other organizations have done lots of polling, and they all come out the same way, which is, number one, people are strongly supportive of Social Security. They think it's more important than ever. They do not want to see benefit cuts. If anything, they think the benefits are too low. They average only $13,000 for all beneficiaries, so certainly not a princely sum. And There are very modest, manageable ways to close the shortfall so that Social Security will be fully funded. The problem is that there's consensus among the population. It's interesting. We ask people if they are Democrats, Republicans, Independents, their age, whether they support the Tea Partiers, whether they have a union member in their household. The percentages were all the same. Overwhelmingly, people support this program. The problem is the disconnect in Washington. The Democrats and Republicans, like some Democrats and virtually all the Republicans, really aren't representing their constituents, because they all are talking about some grand bargain where we have benefit cuts. Minority Leader John Boehner talked about increasing the retirement age to age 70, and some of the Democrats have said that as well. And other kinds of benefit cuts. They always talk about scaling it back for higher income, but it really would hit middle income people the way they're talking about. And it's important, I think, for for constituents and voters to let their elected officials know that that is not acceptable.
Thanks, Linda. Steve in Jackson, hi.
Oh, hi. How are you? Great program. I'm currently on Social Security, and I, too, think it's the greatest program the government has ever devised. I do believe it is a forced savings program, which I believe was the intent of it. And I'm just wondering what you think of the idea of, instead of people playing the gamble of their 401k money and putting it in the stock market, if they were allowed to increase their portion of the Social Security tax that they pay, which would allow them to get a larger benefit at the end when they need it.
Well, the idea of Social Security is that it's insurance, that if you're dependent on wages, you need insurance against the loss of those wages. It's savings are terrific, but it is that should be on top of basic insurance. There are certain things you can't save for. It's very hard to save for uncertain events, like you have a disabling illness or accident at age 35. There's no way you can save for that. The same thing if you die prematurely leaving young children. You can't save for that. It's also very hard. It's been very hard historically to be able to save for old age. When you're younger, you have more pressing needs. You've got housing and education and so forth. And you don't know whether you're going to live, how long you're going to live. Will you make it to retirement or will you live to 120? The wonderful thing about insurances and Social Security is that you cannot outlive it. You can outlive your savings, but you cannot outlive that. So I believe that we should have across the board increase in benefits, and that can be paid for in a number of different ways. But rather than have individuals making the choice, I think we should make a decision as a country that Social Security works so well, there are so many problems with a private pension system, that we will simply continue in this way that we know that works, that has very low administrative costs, and that is already up and running and working beautifully.
Thanks, Steve. Roger in Hudson. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Roger. It's a little noisy.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
All right.
My question has to do with, I'm currently drawing a pension and Social Security, but I've also worked for the past 4 years to supplement my income. My current employer is going through some downsizing, and there's a strong likelihood that I may lose my job. And it's my understanding that I will not be eligible for unemployment because I am on Social Security and pension. Is that correct?
That doesn't sound right to me, but I may be, I know that there has been a spike in claims for early retirement benefits because of this recession, that people have gone in and claimed unemployment. I think that depends on state law, and I think that's a question of Wisconsin law. I'm sorry that I can't answer you.
Okay. And if we could go back for just a moment and talk about the wildly different projections we have for the future of Social Security. There are people, alarmists, who are saying that there just aren't enough people putting money into this. This program is going bankrupt. We need to act immediately. Others are saying this is not the case. We've had commission after commission after commission on the future of Social Security. Why do we get such wildly different information about this program?
Well, it's a very good question. There have always, let me try to give you a little bit of a nuanced answer. There have always been people from the beginning, starting back before it was enacted 75 years ago, who believed that the government had no place in providing or in helping facilitate middle-class benefits, middle-class insurance, which is what Social Security largely is. So they thought that was just not the role of the government. And they would call this socialism and so forth. During the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, as you mentioned, my book is called The Battle for Social Security. And it goes from FDR's vision to Bush's gamble, because in every generation there have been those who've had that view. The American people rejected that view. And it was first put up in 1936, the year after the whole law was enacted. It was a big fight in the presidential campaign, and President Roosevelt won overwhelmingly. It came up again in the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1960s. Barry Goldwater talking about it being needing to be voluntary. At some point, either those people stopped, there stopped being people who thought that, or they changed their tactics. Because starting in the 1970s, everyone started saying Social Security is wonderful, but, and it was what came after the but, it's unaffordable. It's unfair to African Americans because they don't live as long. It's unfair to high-income people because they won't get as high a rate of return. I mean, there were always the but. There were always a reason that this program was bad. And they've sown a lot of uncertainty about every time there's a projection that the program has a long-range projected shortfall, it's bankruptcy crisis. The program can't go bankrupt because it's mainly funded through current workers' contributions. But they've really penetrated the public consciousness, and unfortunately, most people don't have misgivings about the future of the program for just the reasons you said. If you look at, there's an annual trustees report. The most recent one came out just August 5th, and there it states benefits can be paid till 2037 with no action whatsoever.
Hmm.
That does not, in my book, I would not define that as a crisis.
Let's go to Ralph from Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi. I called, actually, and hadn't heard the first half of the program, but when I heard Social Security, I guess I just had to interject my suggestion. When I recall this as a, you know, in grade school and high school, when I was many years ago in school, they would show you a pie chart of the federal budget, and that pie chart never included Social Security. When they looked at the budget for the federal government, it was not including Social Security. Now it's kind of been folded into the budget so that people can say, well, the problem that we've got with our budget right now is that almost half of it is social programs. So I wonder how did that ever happen that they ended up actually folding it into the budget, and it seems like a little bit of trickery that then that way they can raid that fund a lot easier. Looking at the actuary tables and looking at my contribution, based on a 5% increase, if I was to take the money that I put into the program, invested at 5% since 1962, I would come out with $172,000, which would pay my payments until I'm 77 years old, which is probably close to my actuary age. So I guess it infuriates me when people talk as though this people receiving Social Security are getting something from the government, because they're not. They're getting the money they invested in the program in the first place.
That's absolutely right. It's an earned right. And you make a very important point about the budgetary presentation. It's valuable, and economists tend to look at the budget as a unified whole for thinking about fiscal policy. But Social Security, past Congresses have worked very hard to keep Social Security separate and apart. Its money is held in trust. It's a pension fund, just as private employers have to hold their company pension plan assets in trust, Social Security's assets are held in trust. It currently has a surplus of $2.5 trillion, which is going to grow by 2024, according to this latest actuarial report, to $4.2 trillion. So it's in as I say, it's the most conservative and responsible part of the entire federal budget. It is required by law to be presented off budget. But, of course, people can put it together. And, in fact, now, as you're exactly right, you see these unified budgets, which are very deceptive, showing Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. There's, you know, the so-called entitlements taking up so much of the budget. Social Security has its own dedicated revenue, mainly contributions of workers and their employers, and the caller is exactly right. It's a benefit that's earned, that belongs to the people of this country. This In fact, the American workers and their families are the largest creditor of the United States because they hold treasury bonds as a result of Social Security.
And thanks very much for your call. We're talking about Social Security. This is the 75th anniversary, and this month marks the 75th anniversary of the bill being signed into law. Our guest this portion of the show is Professor Nancy Altman, chair of the board of directors of the Pension Rights Center, author of The Battle for Social Security, From FDR's Vision to Bush's Gamble. She is also spearheading the Strengthen Social Security program, and we're welcoming phone calls for her. 800-486-8655 is our number. Email is up and running. Hasn't been used much today, but feel free to send your questions that way or comments. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone call, Steve in Madison. Hi.
Yeah. Good morning. I wanted to ask either of the guests if they have any insight as to why President Obama appointed Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, who are both strong opponents of security, Social Security, to be joint heads of the current commission. If the guests had any input, whether they were asked at all about who might best be on that commission.
The answer is that we fought very hard against this deficit commission that was first proposed last November, December as a statutory commission, and were successful in voting that down. But a lot of pressure was put on the president to establish one by executive order, which he did on February 19th. As the caller said, he has appointed a number of members of this commission who are have been very clear in their view that Social Security benefits should be cut. I think, quite honestly, the president was not thinking about that. I think the attraction of Alan Simpson, a former senator from Wyoming, who is has been very made a number of hostile comments about the program and disparaging comments both about seniors and about Social Security, was seen as a moderate Republican who could accept some taxes, and so he might be a good choice to try to bring about a compromise. But the laser-like focus has been on Social Security. As was said when I was introduced, I've co-chairing a coalition and campaign of over 125 organizations representing 50 million Americans and are trying to sound the alarm about this commission. It's scheduled to report December 1, and if it reaches consensus, its recommendations could be brought up as early as the lame duck this December. So it is something for people to be aware of and make clear to their members that this is unacceptable.
And thank you very much for your call. Let us go next to Charles in Ingleside. Hello, Charles.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Charles.
Good morning. I was wondering if the problem is too few workers supporting recipients, why don't we put the millions of governmental workers into a simple one retirement, one Medicare program like Social Security? Put them all in, everybody.
Well, federal workers are part of Social Security as of 1983. They've been included. It is an almost universal program. There are about 25% of state and local employees who are not covered, but other than that, it's pretty universal. The aging of the population causes the program to be more expensive, but those costs the demographic aging of the baby boom has been fully taken into account. It was taken to the baby boom didn't just surprise everybody. The actuaries produce reports every single year. So as soon as those babies started being born in 1946, 1947, 1948, they were aware of the change in fertility rates, and then they were aware again in the so-called baby bust period. The retirement age is currently increasing from age 65 to 67, which is about a 13% across-the-board benefit cut already in place. That was done to restore the to in anticipation of the baby boom. The other thing that was done was that people paid higher FICA than was required for the current benefits in the 1990s to build up a trust fund to pay for the in anticipation of the baby boom retiring. So as I mentioned before, there is a $2.5 trillion surplus.
That's pretty big.
Security trust fund.
Right.
It is very big, and it's growing. It's still in surplus and growing to, they anticipate, $4.2 trillion in about, by about 20, in about 15 years.
Anything else, Charles? Charles is gone. Thanks very much for your call. Matt in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
The conservative economist Walter Williams had an article out recently, just in the last couple of weeks, where he suggested that retirees from past years are getting more than they paid in, whereas retirees in the near future will be paying in a lot more than they will ever hope to get from Social Security. I don't know about the truth of that or not. Maybe your guest can comment on it. And then I just have one comment, and that is, that, you know, the economic crash of 2008 caught all the big thinkers by surprise, all the economists and stuff, pretty much, most of them. And I'm wondering if, you know, the predictions about the economic health in general upon which, you know, Social Security is based are perhaps maybe too rosy. You know, if we don't grow at optimistic rates like 5% per year or whatever, if we have a downturn for a while, how's that going to affect Social Security?
A very good question. I mean, the Social Security again is an insurance program, and it is funded primarily from the wages of the contributions of workers and their employees. There has been from the beginning some who thought that at some point we should have a broader revenue source for the program. In addition, just as a small supplement. Because the decision was made early on in the program that there were people who were, was in the Depression, people who were close to retirement, and if we, if they gave what was, would be a fair benefit based on what they paid in, they had very few years to pay in, they would have very low benefits. So what was done with Social Security is what's done with many private pension plans as well. They grandfathered in those early retirees. It made, I think it was the right decision. It made good policy sense. Otherwise, we would have had to wait much longer for adequate benefits. But it did create what is called a legacy debt, a legacy cost to the program. And it's interesting, at the introduction of the hour, there was discussion of Thomas Paine and his,
yes,
view that there should be an estate tax. The federal estate tax is now down to zero. When it was the year before, it went to zero. It was residual. The top 1% paid over 99% of the of all the revenue. It was estates over $3.5 million that were affected at all. If we reinstated it at that 2009 rate and dedicated that resource, that revenue to Social Security, that would eliminate about a quarter of the shortfall. So it's a legacies for legacy debt. And it is a way to take care of the implicit question in what Walter Williams was quoted as saying about return, because some of what we're still paying for is this early debt that we all I think our policymakers made the right decision at the time. In terms of how rosy the economic predictions are, the actuaries actually every year make three different projections based on three different sets of assumptions, an optimistic one they think is most likely that they call intermediate, and a pessimistic one, which does have much more pessimistic assumptions, not only about economic growth, but also about fertility rates and so forth, and worker participation and so forth. Under the most optimistic projections, there's actually no problem whatsoever. And obviously, under the more pessimistic one, there's still affordable, but a larger shortfall. That's why the program makes projections every single year, because it can take into account what has happened. So the economy of the last few years was fully taken into account in this most recent 2005 report. What's happening this year will be fully taken into account in the 2011 report. And that's why American people, I think, should be reassured. The idea of Social Security is not just to provide cash benefits, but to provide security, a peace of mind that the program will be there. And part of the reasons it's monitored so closely and for 75 years is to make sure that a worker entering the workforce at 20 years old today will be 95 at the end of that valuation period. Mm-hmm. It is a longer valuation period than any private pension plan uses and that most other countries use as well.
Thank you, Nancy, so much for being with us. We're plumb out of time.
Oh,
thank
sorry.
You. Appreciate all your knowledge. Nancy Altman is chair of the board of directors of the Pension Rights Center, author of The Battle for Social Security, and also spearheading Strengthen Social Security. We mark the 75th anniversary of the program this month. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and to Chrissy for on-air production. Until tomorrow, everybody.